This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This is the Book Wrap Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill, joined today by Sharifa Williams, who's filling in for Rebecca, who is sending me pictures from the show floor of the Public Library Association's annual conference. She's there doing work things. There was, maybe I'll put this in the Patreon. I don't know. I'm not sure if these were public consumption or I would have already put them in there. One, which is clearly a Where the Crawdads Sing, how to put this kind of Sharifa. Descendant.
Ah, I see. Okay.
And one of which, yes, and one with some particularly good puns. Sharifa, who is podcasting with me, learning how to podcast again.
Yes.
Because she has been out and reminding herself how those things go.
I got it eventually. Back. Thank you.
We did.
It's amazing how much you can forget or lose muscle memory for after like 3 and some odd months. Wild.
Well, we were saying it is the behind the scenes stuff about how we do podcasts over at Book Riot. We're pretty homemade, right? We have our own computers. We don't get into studios. We edit the shows ourselves. But even just plugging the headphones in and plugging the mic in and getting the things to come out and go in the right holes is not as simple as you would think it would be.
Nope. No, it is not, as I learned today. But it's okay. We're all good now.
We can hear each other. We're doing fine. We've got a week's worth of news to get to. A couple of reminders. There's no Patreon episode this week with Rebecca out. But having said that, we will be book clubbing for the Book Riot Patreon through James by Percival Everett, which will prove to be an interesting discussion, I'm sure, when we get to it next week. I guess this is on the agenda for today's, but I'll point people to it before we get to it. I wrote for the Book Riot podcast deep dive newsletter, not the podcast newsletter, good Lord, the Book Riot deep dive newsletter, a post titled What I Would Do If I Were Starting Book Riot Today, which is a mini history of Book Riot itself, but also kind of a state of the media industry right now. We've talked a lot on the show about publications going in and out and why the media landscape is the way it is. And I thought I would give our little microcosm view of it. I'm not sure if Rebecca had a chance to read it, but Sharifa probably did because I put it in the agenda today.
Yes.
And you've been around in a lot of different stages. I'll be curious to hear your thoughts there. Probably do that at the end of the show today.
Yeah.
And then there's news all around. So we'll do our first sponsor break and then get into the news.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild at heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult / crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by TorBooks. So if you are a fan of epic fantasy, if you're a fan of Scott Lynch and or Joe Abercrombie, but you want something a little different, you want a hero who's like a bit of a mess, then The Silver Blood Promise by James Logan is for you. In it, Academy dropout slash disgraced noble heir Lacan Gordova's life is in shambles. All he's got going for him is, one, he is a card sharp of considerable skill, and two, a lot of... maybe potentially a little too much wine. So those are the positives. So when the bizarre murder of his father robs him of even the off chance of redemption, Lacan decides to make amends another way. He's going to unravel the mystery behind the killing, even if it takes him to the underbelly of Sophrona, a city of danger, secrets, and merchant princes. Finding the truth is one thing. Finding the truth and staying alive is like a whole other thing. So make sure to check out The Silver Blood Promise by James Logan on sale May 7th. And thanks again to TorBooks for sponsoring this episode.
So I had never considered myself in a real way that the way books package themselves could be a avenue for, I guess, climate change activism. Mm-hmm. So I thought this was a really fascinating look at HarperCollins' efforts to buy and use fewer trees, I guess, essentially, Sharifa, in the form of font design.
Yeah.
You yourself are a visually inclined person. You're an illustrator, an artist in your own regard. I'm not. Are you a font freak? I'm a bit of a font freak. In some degrees, fonts matter to me. I will notice a font if I hate it, but I guess that's as far as I go. But I will go look at the font note at the end of the Decal Edge literary fiction title I'm almost surely reading if there is a note on the font at the end. What did you think of this piece? And I guess, is this something that ever occurred to you before?
It honestly isn't. Like, I'm usually very focused on visual things, but for whatever reason, when I'm reading, fonts just don't, unless they're really unusual, fonts don't really, yeah, like, scream out at me. And I do not look at font notes or anything like that. I feel pretty good leaving it at reading the acknowledgments, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I read that book inside and out. That's all I need to know. I will occasionally look at book cover designers and illustrators and things like that. But yes, until I looked at this article, I was like, wow, it's amazing to me how little I've really thought about fonts and how much of an impact they can have on, you know, a publisher's, I don't know, it's probably like, there's a part of me that's like, yes, on the climate and the planet, and that's great. And probably also, mm-hmm, the bottom line, because, you know, paper, yeah, is also expensive. There's been shortages, and, you know, that's probably something, mm-hmm, lots of publishers are thinking about. But now I feel like I'm going to look at every book I pick up and I have to know about the font. So yeah. This was an interesting and insightful piece for me.
I should shout some names out. So there'll be a link in the show notes, bookwrite.com/listen. But the piece is in Fast Company, written by Elizabeth Segran, Segran. Interviewed, it sound primarily folks at HarperCollins and then Tracy Menzies. Boy, they don't give you pronunciation guides in text in this, so I'm doing my best here, who is the VP of Creative Operations and Production at HarperCollins. So this started in 2017, or at least the narrative is presented here in a real way in 2017, but started by a division of HarperCollins in 2015. And I'm going to give the listeners a minute to guess what kind of book was probably most incentivized to see if they could print in fewer pages? I'm going to give you, I don't know, how long is the Jeopardy theme song? It's like seven. I'm not going to sing it.
No, I know. I immediately heard it everyone. In my head.
Yeah. And copyright protected. I'm sure they'd come after me over at the Sony lot. I have toured the Jeopardy studio at the Sony
That's
lot.
Cool.
And let me just say they're provisioned to protect their intellectual property.
Mm.
Are you thinking? So you might think about what books get sold a lot, what books have a lot of pages, and that those pages are very text dense.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a guess? I wish we could do a live thing with the audience. Maybe we could do that. So Bibles.
Yes.
So Zondervan Bibles, which is a division of HarperCollins Christian, which is a division of HarperCollins, makes sense, right? You know, 2,500 pages historically, apparently, that's what Bibles have used. If you can do better, Bibles sell a lot and there are a lot of pages. So they developed a new compact typeface called NIV Comfort Print. And it saved 350 pages per Bible. And combined with all the Bibles, Zondervan Bibles sold in 2017, that was 100 million pages.
Man.
Helpfully, the visual we get here, that would be four times the height of the Empire State Building. So you could stack up Bibles, the equivalent of four Empire State Buildings, and that's how much they saved.
It's a lot of pages.
And like, huh, turns out we publish other things besides Bibles, Sharifa, right? Not something apparently they had thought about before. So they started with larger books, 600 pages plus, used some off-the-shelf fonts, eventually got down to 15, and they've got this one font it sounds like they're using called Bembo, which is not Bilbo Baggins. it's actually a font size. And they are saving pages and pages and pages of books. So the one they give an example of, I don't know if this is sort of branding publicity, but if it is, it's smart. This book called So Fetch, kind of a regular, you know, memoir book that you know, you're going to get. These are the kinds of books that HarperCollins writ large and the publishing industry at large are going to publish a lot of. Went to this smaller, it's not smaller, it's more compact. So there's less space between letters, even sometimes how of the individual characters fit together can save. So Fetch itself saved 1 million pages of print over the totality of its print run, and that's just one print title.
Yeah.
So this really adds up. And I had never thought about this before. I'm not sure what else to say about it, but I'd be fascinated to hear if the random houses of other people picking this up, because you have this whole piece is presented as a look how great it is for the environment. I am guessing that's not what they started.
No.
I'm guessing it was like, can we make these Bibles less expensive?
I thought it was very funny how the article was positioned, and I was waiting to hear something about, oh, you know, it's expensive and all that. And I didn't really get a lot of that, but that was the first thing that occurred to me. And I cannot imagine a world where other publishers do not pick up on this, because
I can't. Yeah.
Why wouldn't they? Right. But I do wonder, like, would they have to come up with their own font? Is this something that's shareable, or do they have to run their own, you know, delightfully harmless and nerdy covert font experiments on readers? Like, do they have to reinvent the wheel, or is this something HarperCollins would like share with other publishers and they could utilize?
It's a great point.
Yeah.
So I guess a real-time emendation. Bembo was the old font, and they went to Garamond Pro in this one example. So just to say that out loud. And Garamond is that's an extant font. I don't know if Pro is HarperCollins' own version of it. Typefaces can be copyrighted, are subject to intellectual property. One thing you would learn, Sharifa, if you took the time like a real nerd to read your note on the typeface, is that many of them were invented by like some Dutchman in 1748. And I think that was, you know, a great time for printing, is those early days, a lot of going on. But also those are outside of copyright. You don't have to pay no royalties on whatever Dutchman's random ass font from 1748. But some of these other things you do, I mean, again, notably, there's a reason that Arial is what you can pick in Microsoft Word, not Helvetica, because Arial was developed by Microsoft to look and feel exactly like Helvetica and be slightly different enough where they cannot be sued by the owners of Helvetica. I have watched a documentary about the typeface Helvetica. Yes,
of
I can.
Course.
It's extremely interesting.
Of course you have.
And, you know, if you're listening to this show, you know that's not beyond the pale. for me. So I thought this was extremely interesting. I'm interested in all assets of the physical book design itself. I wonder. So a 350 pages out of of a 2,500 page Bible, they're looking at a 12-15% reduction. And then, of course, that is not just printing and paper costs. That's also shipping costs.
Yeah, right.
As the cost of shipping has gone up, you can get more Bibles in fewer containers, especially over COVID when, getting containers. Remember that year there was actual problem with getting the containers full of books to America from China, like in time for the holiday season?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing about paper and paper shortages and stuff, I had never thought about that until the pandemic. Yeah. And then there were the shipping issues and things like... It was like learning about the guts of publishing through the pandemic, weirdly. But I have vivid memories of that because I think we were writing news stories about it all the time.
Right. Well, it was a real... There was one book in particular that... I can't remember what it was. It might have been Michelle Obama's memoir that was in high demand. I think it was right in the middle of COVID. And I think they were worried about getting it on the container ships. And I don't remember what happened. Clearly, it sold plenty of copies, but I don't remember what supply side there.
Yeah.
When you were doing Fit for the Gods, they didn't ask you about typeface. They just said, here's what it looks like.
Yeah, they did not ask for our contributions about... Actually, okay. They did about, I believe, the book cover itself.
The book cover.
Yeah, and I think the section pages, like bigger header fonts and things like that, but they were not interested in our opinions about, which is fair because I don't know I would have said. I've been like, they all look okay to me, go to print.
you weren't like, what about Norm Flyberger's 1485 font?
Exactly. No.
I'm just making up. I'm sorry to all Dutch people everywhere for making up names. There is an example on this page between Bembo and Garamond Pro, and Garamond Pro, to my eye, actually is more pleasurable to read. It you can see side by side, it's a little bit denser, but the Bembo really looks like there's a lot of space there, and maybe they're cherry picking from one that is extremely, I don't know, it's the gas guzzler of page usage, but to my mind, not only does Garamond Pro seem not less desirable to read, I think it's actually slightly more desirable to read. So... That's real insider stuff. Welcome to the Book Riot Podcast. If this is your first episode, I can't say it's not indicative, but it's all not cover and typeface design.
No.
There too. Yeah. Speaking of the ins and outs of pricing, I don't remember off the top of my head, before we get into some Spotify news, where are you on the audiobook train? Are you in the caboose? You're not on the train. You're more of a pedestrian. I don't remember where you are, Sheree.
I'm almost exclusively... This is why the paper conversation was also so funny to me, because I am almost exclusively now an audiobook reader. I don't often pick up physical books, and my audiobook platform of choice is Libro FM. So Spotify as an audiobook... provider is such a is still like an alien concept to me, even though I know that they've been doing this and working hard at it for a while, trying to get that audience and trying to get readers over there. But I'm like, I can't think of anybody I know who uses Spotify for audiobooks. And I'm so like, the whole thing fascinates.
Well, you know, at least one, because you're talking to him right now. It goes into my mix in this way, which is, I was already a Spotify premium member. And I get 15 hours of audiobooks for free. Right. Rebecca and I have both done this. Again, it's hours. I can't share it only the primary with my kids or whatever. There's some limitations to it. But since I was already paying my, I think, $14.99 to Spotify Family Premium, I've got whatever the Rolls Royce of the Spotify account is. I couldn't pay more to Spotify if I wanted to. Well, they're going to give me that chance, it sounds like. And this is something... I talked about somewhere, I don't remember if it was in the newsletter or wherever it was, but basically saying, it was actually just last week when I was giving Rebecca a bit of a download from my time in New York talking to publishers and how much publishers were thrilled with Spotify because A, they were presenting another option and feel like could be a real Pepsi to Audible's Coke in the audiobook platform wars. There are Libro FM, Barnes & Noble, Apple, but there's really one player, 95%. One publisher told me 95% of their audiobook sales came through Audible.
Wow.
And having another player could mean Audible might be easier to work with. A little diversity is never bad for anyone in all situations, even when it comes to distribution of audiobooks. But I was thinking through this, is like, well, that is all new money flowing directly from Spotify to publishers, because I'm not paying any more money to Spotify. So that's coming out of Spotify's cut.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know how long that's going to last, because if audiobook publishers are this happy, it means they're getting a pretty good cut of something. And Spotify is subsidizing them all itself. And I didn't think that was going to last forever. And lo and behold, barely 72 hours went by since that episode went up, that there's rumors that Spotify might be raising prices again. And I don't know if people know this, but oftentimes these streamers, this is what they do. They seed to the press and media that there's, you know, maybe there's some change coming. So it's not a surprise overnight when you see a pop-up in your Netflix or HBO Max or whatever you're doing, that some people at least know the stories are out there. And the stories aren't Spotify does a surprise price hike. It's Spotify, as expected, raise prices. And that can help tamp down the fire suppressant of people getting really mad. So I take this as more of a Spotify is going to raise prices, even though the stories I saw and the one I'll link to is rumors, whatever.
Yeah.
It looks to me, and this makes a lot of sense to me, is you will be able to buy the old Spotify premium membership at the old price and you'll have no audiobook credit with it. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And if you want an audiobook price, you'll pay a few more bucks and you'll get that. That also makes sense to me. It will be less expensive than buying a credit or an audiobook in a different way, but it won't be quote unquote free with your already existing Spotify membership. I think that's good. I think it's healthy, and I think it's sustainable, and I think it's clear. I thought this was a let's get some market share, make it easy, not confuse people, get them used to buying Spotify or listening to audiobooks on Spotify, and they can deal with it later. That's how these streaming platforms work. First, it's $4.99, then it's $6.99, then $7.99. Now it has ads. They frog boil you into being okay with where they wanted to go, but they want market share at the beginning. They want to make it easy to sign up, and they don't want the price or whatever or the multiple plans to be confusing. So this is what happens. Kind of told you, not a surprise. I don't know what else to say about it, so I put it here. You're not a Spotify person. Where do you do your music?
Yeah.
Then? Are you still on Pandora? You bet.
Oh my goodness!
Playlist you're keeping from 20 years ago.
Wow, I do love Pandora, but I am an Apple Music person, so I don't get to participate in those fun end of year listening recaps like other people do. But you know, I do. I just cannot, for whatever reason, move myself over to Spotify, even with their audiobooks promise. And when I initially read this, I was like, oh my goodness, if they just raise the prices on everybody, what are the people who don't listen to audiobooks going to say? So it does make sense that they are, you know, offering a different deal to those people, because I feel like there would be a lot of people who are big mad about that. Didn't even know that the audiobooks thing was a component and are just there for the music, you know, the Swifties listening to their music and whatnot. Out of curiosity, since I'm never on Spotify, I went to the homepage from like a Google search on my desktop, and right under the popular artists, it lists great first audiobooks. So I could tell they're really pushing that surface and maybe trying to get more people on board, perhaps before they lift the prices. But
right. Yeah. Let get more people addicted, or not addicted, but habituated, I guess, is the less pejorative way of putting that.
Right.
It is surprising. I've got some people in my, I mean, I'm always curious. I think my daughter and I were talking about this the other day. And Spotify would be the last streaming service my family would cancel. You can get rid of Netflix, you get rid of Disney Plus. We listen to music all the time in all places. And if I had to pick one, I would still choose that.
Oh, yeah.
Not the least of which, because I can get an audiobook in there now. But music streaming services are pretty sticky. I'm not sure they're as sticky as cell phone providers, but I don't want to lose my playlists and my like songs
and
everything.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Like, I think that's a real thing. It's a real thing. And it's harder to get people to off. I wonder if it's harder to get people to switch their music subscription service or their audiobook platform. And as soon as I say that, it feels like audiobooks are way easier. It's a commodity. I'm not like saving audiobook playlist. That's kind of a weird idea even just to say out loud. So
yeah.
As a differentiator, I think it's more helpful. I haven't still waiting for some sort of response from Audible on this whole front. I don't know what they can do, but I keep waiting for them to try to take Spotify on. But I don't know what they do, except now Audible has music. That's a whole different deal.
Yeah, that would be very unusual. Maybe they just do not think that, and I don't know if this would be wise. Maybe they just don't think of Spotify as, you know, coming to actually be a threat to them. But I sort of doubt that. I think that they probably are in secret working.
I've heard they are. They're big mad is the phrase I heard about Spotify coming on. I guess Apple would be one that could, they have the music already. It's so fascinating. Apple seems not to care about selling books or music or movies that much. Like, they all have platforms there, but Apple tomorrow could launch a Audiobooks Plus membership.
Yeah, that's
because they
true.
Have Apple Music. Like, if tomorrow Apple launched a for $2 more, you get one audiobook credit a month, that would be pretty attractive to you, I would think, Sharif.
I think so. I mean, I would definitely check it out since I'm, like, probably many people on Spotify who are also readers. If it was just already kind of there at my fingertips, yeah, I probably would just sort of slide into that service, and I also probably would be frog-boiled very easily, so I am surprised that they haven't, but also I truly don't know what they're doing. Like, the only thing I've heard of them doing with Apple Music is changing the name of the platform from iTunes to Apple Music. Like, that is literally as much development as I hear going on over there. So I don't know if they're like, you know, they just think of it as something that exists and they're not really focusing on it, which is wild to me. It would be wild if that's actually how they're thinking about it. But it doesn't seem like they're doing anything new or interesting. And I'm just here because the idea of migrating all of my music makes my eyes feel like they're going to melt out of my head.
Well, my understanding, and I don't know where this has come from. I probably read it somewhere, and I wish I could cite it, is Apple Music, podcasts, all that stuff exists, or books exist, so that if you buy an iPad or iPhone, you don't have to go hunting for something else.
Yeah.
It's just that your phone can, quote-unquote, do it. And so in order to do that, Apple has to have their own storefront. I don't know what kind of margin they're making off it. I'm sure it pales in comparison to what they're making off the devices and other services that they sell you, your storage, your iCloud storage, things like that. But it's kind of table stakes to have a mobile operating system where, without having to go download some other store or to go through some weird third-party thing where if they take a third-party cut and Amazon doesn't want you to buy Kindle books through the app on your iPhone because they don't want to give Apple the 30%, it's just there. So it's for people that want it occasionally, it's there, it's built in. The services look good. They're not especially full-featured or competitive in other ways, but a lot of this entertainment is a commodity. You can get Masters of the Air only on Apple TV+, but you're going to be able to get Barbie or Oppenheimer on whatever platform you happen to do. So the marginal value of making it a great quote-unquote experience is less than just having it there at all.
Right.
And I think it is minimum viable platform for these kinds of places. Now, Spotify and Apple have been at war in the courts over all kinds of things related to e-commerce on Apple's platform. Spotify doesn't have its own phone. It doesn't have its own platform. It relies on the largesse of Android and Apple specifically to exist. So they're in direct competition in many other ways. But I continue to find this interesting as well. I don't know what Audible could do to really directly compete, except they don't want to lower prices. I don't know. Maybe there would be a lower tier for... Is there a way they could have a direct comparison for a 15-hour a month plan that's lower than the $14.95? Because my $14.95 plan gets me a book of any length.
Right.
So I can go listen to Streisand, or I can go listen to... Well, I actually can't listen to the English understandable because there's no audiobook. But it's a 69-page book. That would cost me a credit either way. Well, maybe if I get 15 hours of audiobook listening, I can do it whatever I want. And maybe that's $9.99 rather than $14.99. Maybe something like that. I'm not sure that's going to matter, but that's the only thing I can really imagine.
Yeah.
Whatever they've got going at the Wonka Skunk Works over at Audible, I would be surprised if they're not thinking about it that way. All right. I want to save the what would I do if I were starting Book Riot till the end. So I've got three other stories here. Sri, if you can see.
Yes.
Why don't you pick which one you would like to talk about?
I'd be really sad if we didn't get to the Children's Literature Museum, okay. The rabbit hole. So
all
I'm
right.
going to
Terrific.
Go there.
I'm so glad you picked this. Why don't you tell me about this? Why don't you drive the train on this particular story? Tell people what this is.
Yeah, so this is a piece that's from the New York Times. It's reported by Elizabeth Egan, and it is an amazing story about an amazing, an equally amazing sort of children's literature. I don't even know if I want to call it a museum experience.
Yes, I agree with you. I had that note. Yes.
Yeah, called The Rabbit Hole. And it is like my dream destination. I am so jealous of children who are getting to visit it and explore all of its features. It is this amazing, I think it was equated to the size of a hockey rink space.
Yeah.
And they have installations that are all focused on children's literature. So many books that are familiar to me and from my childhood. I'm sure every millennial parent yep. would go in there and have a bout of nostalgia. And
mm-hmm.
it was created, it's in Kansas City, Missouri, a place I never thought that I would consider visiting because I know nothing about it and why. But now I'm like, I need to get my book my ticket, get on a flight over there with my girls and check it out one day.
I was going to say, you, when I wrote about this in Today in Books, so this is my mom lives in Kansas City, Missouri, not far from this. I think she's been following and telling me about it for a while. It's in an old tin can factory in downtown Kansas City. There's some cool places. Yeah, I think you would dig Kansas City
okay.
anyways, Sharifa, even though you live on a sprawl. You live on the set of a future children's book, by the way. Not to be creepy about people, but you've got some acreage. You've got gardens everywhere. You know, Peter Rabbit could definitely be gallivanting around your homestead.
Oh, so, yeah.
It's not that different than that, but the installations there, these are, and I'm loath to say this, but like kind of Disneyland quality
yes.
installations. Now, they're not rides. They're walkthroughs. But rides are scary for kids. There's this one. It's like, I'm not even sure if what book it comes from, but it's like a series of canyons looking thing that you're down
yeah,
in this
that's
little.
So cool looking.
I don't even know what, it's so cool. My kids just turned 11 and 13. Their birthdays are back to back. A couple, and they're a little too old. I mean, I'm sure they'd enjoy
oh.
walking through it. But I think if you're 5, 6, 7, 8, right, that's or maybe a little younger, when you can walk around and recognize that there's a Blueberries for Sal installation
yeah.
or there's a Caps for Sale. So it's a mix of things we've recognized. And then there's some stuff that they've done installations for underknown books that
mm-hmm.
they think are pretty great too. It's $16 per person over 2 years old. That's not super cheap, but have you gone to the movies recently? That's all I've got to say about that
yeah.
for everyone out there. I mean, it is a private enterprise. It's 40. They're calling them book thing diorama, blown up to life size. It's really cool. I think it's one of the coolest like physical things I've seen in a long time, and we don't really have a word for it, right? So that's
yeah.
also interesting. It's sort of category busting. I hope it does great. This is very much may your effort succeed. It's a nonprofit. It sells. I'm sure they're going to be doing Support Us. It looks terrific. They raised $15 million. They got a board. They made a wish list of books, and they said every ethnicity, every gender, every publisher. We love you. Love
so
to hear
great.
It. They couldn't get rights to everything. They have rights to more than 70 titles. That's one thing I thought right away. It's like, oh, they have to work out IP and copyright
yeah.
stuff. So anyway, that I don't. This is just cool. This
it's
is
really
just cool. And also, shout out to the. Go ahead. You finish up.
Oh, you can give your shout out. I totally want to hear what the shout out is.
I was just going to say the Times itself, like they sent a photographer and the photos are great.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if you're the rabbit hole, you have to be thrilled with this piece, by the way. Because you and I know this is expensive to do a piece like this. As someone, we try to figure out what images to do with our stories we're writing. They sent someone out there. They sent a professional. Like, I know the New York Times gets criticism from a lot of different places. No one else. I don't think there's anyone else that would do a story like this around books in a children's museum. Fly a reporter and a photographer out there and do it. So anyway, that's a separate.
They did an amazing job. Yeah, the pictures, like, I felt like I was there. And I just wished I was there. But yeah. I mean, children's museums, which I don't know if you had any growing up by you. I know they're scattered around, but they're a huge topic of conversation in my house because I think just about everybody in my family and my husband's family has fond memories of children's museums. So when I saw this, I was like, this is the vibe I have been looking for. Like, this is what I feel is missing, at least for my city. I live in Asheville, and I don't know of any children's museums. And I thought it was hilarious how they were, you know, describing some of these other interactive children's spaces, like sticky and smelling of apple juice or something worse, you know. I was like, well, that was probably true of the children's museums, you know, I went to in my childhood. But there was also just something so wonderful about being let loose and having this exploratory experience as a child and discovering things. And in the case of the children's museum I went to, it was often like science-y stuff. But it was just like being able to explore and have a space that was specifically meant for you and installations and types of, you know, that type of thing that was just, I think it just draws out the imagination of a child so well. So I think that it's just amazing to me that they were actually able to, one, dream this up and then execute on it in a way that is like the polar opposite of that terrible Wonka experience that everybody has been lampooning across
the internet. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, totally. And you know, it's interesting too. I was at my family and I were in Seattle a couple weekends ago, and we went to the MoPOP Museum, Museum of Pop Culture, which is this fancy Frank Gehry designed building at the base of the Space Needle. And it's super modern, and there's a lot of screens, internet activity. And I was like, that's great. One thing that I like about this is it's super analog. I don't see a digital display in any of these pictures. Like, it's very hands-on, built. You know, all of the installations are physical, right? You're interacting with this kitchen or this diorama or this, you know, these pictures and reliefs of animals. Like, you're touching them physical on the wall. There's, you know, the room from Goodnight Moon is recreated, and it's all physical stuff. It's just right there. And I wonder, after having thousands of four-year-olds go through there, how many of these phones and clocks are going to have to rebuild and restore. But at least they're not, you know, $2,000 OLED screens. Like, you know, maybe these are meant to be replaced and done by hand. So I think that's great, too. And, you know, there was a children's museum in Portland that my kids went to once. It's since closed down. I think COVID was extremely hard on that because they were children's museums are germ factories before. With all the secretions you were alluding to, plus some. And OMSI here, I mean, the science museums tend to be a good fit for kids of all ages, right? And this, but on the humanities front, there tend not to be many because the next step is to an art museum. And those are great, but they're not super conducive to 4 and 5 year olds. Mm-mm. It's a lot of don't touch and oh my gods that if you're walking your kids around that. So this is creates this different kind of a space, which is interesting. There's a miniature toy museum in Kansas City that's very cool. I'll write up a whole itinerary for you, Sharifa, when you go. I can tell you all the spots you can go.
That sounds great.
In Kansas City.
I mean, when they install their rooftop bar, which is apparently coming, that's basically when I'll be headed over there. So you have a little time.
You need the kids. You need your daughters to be a few years old, walking around and being able to.
That helps.
I appreciate it a little bit. But the kind of thing that, I don't know, is for people coming from out of town, will they go?
I hope so.
I think so. If you've got kids, there's just nothing like this. There just really isn't. That's exactly like this. So that's very cool. I'm glad you picked that one out. I'm going to save, this is a preview, I'll save for Rebecca, Indigo Bookstore Going Private and Amazon's Grab and Go Sham. So that's a tease, what we call in the business. Yeah, it's nice. Unusual doing a podcast setting, but we'll get to those a little bit later. Let me do one more sponsor break and we can talk about this little piece I wrote.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. Let me ask you a question. How well do you think you know people? And how well do you think they know you? 6 award-winning, best-selling authors of suspense explore the lingering threat of secrets and the inescapable fear that they can't stay buried forever. So no matter how dark the hiding place, the consequences of revealing the truth can bring out the worst in lovers, friends, family, and strangers. And check this out. You can read and listen to all 6 short stories in the Never Tell collection free with Prime. You can learn more at amazon.com/nevertell. And these best-selling authors include Liv Constantine, Laurith Ann White, Andrea Bartz, Rachel Housel Hall, Avi Pachoda, and Carolyn Kepnes. Again, you can read and listen to all 6 short stories free with Prime and also Kindle Unlimited. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
So this was a piece I wrote for the deep dive. And the impetus was, what was the impetus? I guess I was on the same listening tour I was doing, and I get the opportunity to talk about the site and the history and everything that goes on along with it. And it got me thinking about that particular time. It came out a very specific time in the sort of the late version, the late stages of blogging being the thing that was going on. I know it sounds like saying that ham radio was the thing, but there was a time, trust me, when blogging was the thing. And, you know, basically there were a bunch of people writing as hobbyists, not getting paid at all. And I was doing it myself. So it was Rebecca, there's Amanda Nelson, other people. I don't think you were writing about food quite yet in 2009, but you soon were to do your own kind of blogging stuff a little bit later. You got brought on the train when we were doing Food Riot. And putting one on the one roof and sort of giving a little, some spit and polish, right? Seeing if we could do something together. And it worked. You know, we're still here. We've grown. We've got people. You know, it's chugging along. But the long story short is I would not try to do that today. I just wouldn't. Text on the web is too hard to start from scratch right now. I think if you're an individual writer, Substack is extremely interesting. We do a bunch of newsletters ourselves. It's a part of our business. But it would not be enough for me alone to try to do a multi-pronged, especially covering something as big as books. Now, there have been some things that do this, but I wouldn't start it myself because we started and social media was pre-algorithmized. I don't even know how to say that word. It comes out of my mouth sounding like gobbledygook. But it was the pre-algorithm days. Yeah. And between RSS and Twitter, we could get some audience. People would share and find out about what we did. And we got enough people into it that we had our own audience that we could transport and start building our own way. Facebook came on about a year later for us. We got good at that. We had about a year of pre-algorithm Facebook. And that got us some, and it gave us a chance to build a brand before the algorithm started sweeping in and cutting off people's engagement, where you had to pay or just a fraction of people would even see a thing. You know, something I put something on Facebook the other day. I took this picture of a local thing. I don't know what you call it, but it was called the Dog's Little Free Library. Take a branch, leave a branch. I took a picture, put it on Facebook, and it did well on Facebook, but Of our almost 900,000 followers, it only got to about 60,000 of them. So less than 10% of a good, that's a fun post. People liked it. A thousand people liked it. People are sharing it all over the place. But it just doesn't go to everyone because the algorithm does what it does. And that is such a headwind to starting something new. I think if you're an individual, you do Substack, maybe you get on the social video train. You try to go viral and do and make content for a niche and do it that way. But for a company with a dozen or more employees and contributors to boot, it's a lot of work. And my upshot was not to be sad about it, but try to be grateful that we got lucky and we worked hard and we have something. But kind of ashamed that, like, what's the last media company that started that people have heard of? Even Defector, I guess, coming out of some of that. But other than that, I can't really name anything else. And I think if anything, they've gone away. They've gone belly up. So I don't know. I mean, you've been around for a lot. This is nothing new to you, Sharifa, maybe packaged in a specific way. Was there anything in my piece that you felt especially strongly about or resonated with you? Or what did I omit or what would you add?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely remember I wasn't around, of course, when Book Riot first started. I think I was working on my little WordPress blog about writing loosely, but I remember that sort of cozy, bloggy atmosphere, and I always sort of wish I had been around for those early days to, like, be in on something collaborative like that, because it would have been really fun, which these days it's still fun, you know, but there are just a lot more challenges. Like, you have to do so much more pivoting because the media landscape and its supports just change so frequently. Like, we had the algorithm, and that was a huge one. We've got, you know, AI coming up, and there are you just can't sort of, like, do the, let me just sit back and write some things and, you know, and people will come and read.
Just do good content doesn't work.
If you write it, they will come.
Just good content doesn't work.
You know, you come up with a strategy, and just as you settle into it, the rules kind of change. And, you know, as somebody who's deeply embedded in, like, content and what that strategy should look like, it can be a little bit like, oh, you miss those earlier days before all of these trappings showed up and made it kind of difficult to get your stuff in front of people. And this is coming from a place of, like, Book Riot's been around for a long time. We have established followers. We have people who have, you know, been readers since the beginning of time. And it's still incredibly challenging. And I truly can't imagine a media company, like, especially a literary media company, coming around and trying to start from scratch in this environment. I don't know what that would look like. It would. I would not buy into that myself. I can't imagine starting from scratch like that. So that part of it definitely resonated with me. Like, I'm not even somebody who has founded a thing like that, but even participating in something like that just feels like you have to be, like, best friends with that person and just want to support them, because that's the only thing make you, you know, that would make a person try to start a media company in that way right now. But
It's tough. And I guess I'm not a huge fan, as people know, of the TikToks and Instagram reels and the Facebook reels of the world, the world of the algorithm. Though I did make my first TikTok. I'll put a link in the show notes there as I was playing around with it. But I guess on the one hand, at least, now, not to say that something, but at least if you're entering into an environment where you understand the dragon you're trying to ride, maybe that's something. Like, okay, it's already an algorithm. I think the shift is what's hard. Like, thinking you're going in with one business model and one distribution platform and one set of results you might be able to expect, and then having the rolled rug pulled out from under you, which always can happen, right? It always can happen where you got really good as a still photographer on Instagram, but then suddenly video is the thing. Or maybe you got awesome at TikTok when one kind of content was ascendant, or before ByteDance decided to leave the US rather than divest. I don't know what's going to happen with all this. Maybe it'll go out and fizzle. Maybe it won't. But even unless you own the underlying technology and platform, you are subject to someone changing it. And those platforms are competing with each other, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Facebook got caught flat-footed by video, especially user-generated video. They did the pivot to video, which killed some companies like 5 or 6 years ago. But that wasn't user-generated content. That was, they wanted companies making beautiful, awesome videos on Facebook, and they were paying outrageous sums to get people to do it, and it fell apart, and then people invested a bunch in cameras and staff and studio spaces, and that got left holding the bag. But even within these platforms, they are shifting, they are competing with each other, they don't have it figured out, and they are subject to other kinds of regulations and other kinds of things. So, and maybe I'm imagining a time where it was easy for publishers. There was a time Warren Buffett was buying up local newspapers because he couldn't imagine a threat to, say, the Buffalo newspaper. Because there wasn't one.
Yeah.
And that went on for 70 years, right? And they're all well and good until it isn't. And so I kind of end my piece with gratitude, but also the day I say, you know, we've got this figured out, is the day you're about to get hit by a train coming in another direction. Mm-hmm. Because you're never going to have it figured out. And trying to take some solace in that, and trying to figure out what's working and what's not, and moving from one thing to the next, and abandoning the old to take up the new, even as you try to have some sort of, you know, consistency. That is the nature of technology. That's the nature of media, and that's the nature of capitalism, frankly, because it's a competitive environment, and people are always trying to take your margin and do something that you're making money off in a cheaper, better, more scalable way. That's always going to happen. So I don't know if there's solace in that, but there's a sort of resignation that's like, okay, it's not just you. It's going to be this way. And if you think you don't have to do it, you're probably going to find yourself writing one of those emails that say, after many years, I'm sorry, but today's our last day, which is the email I don't want to write.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's helpful in that, you know, acknowledging that in order to succeed and in order to even enjoy the work, if you're in the work, is
yes,
you have to have a certain yes spirit of, you know, enthusiasm and excitement for dabbling and trying new things, because it just moves so quickly, and you cannot just sit on something you think is successful and think it's going to be successful for a while. So as long as there's like that enthusiasm and excitement and curiosity, I think that it is like, I think it's still an interesting place to be, even though there are some things I wish would go away, like the algorithm.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I'd be curious to know, like, if you're running a newspaper in 1991, say, like, what were the what was the competitive landscape happening?
Yeah.
Or was the Kansas City Star really just raking in dollars?
Right.
And kind of just, you know, cranking it out. Because, like, the Post and the Times, right, and, you know, if you've seen, not Spotlight so much, but, like, the paper or, well, even Spotlight, they're competing with another newspaper. So maybe that's what it would be. It's like you're competing with the other paper in your town for the scoops.
Yeah.
I guess that's what it would have been. Which seems so quaint.
It does.
In a way. I mean, those are serious stories, but that idea seems like, I don't think of us competing with Lit Hub for a scoop. It's like, even, it feels silly just to say that out loud.
Yeah, that's not really I don't think that's the business we're in, you know?
No.
When I think of stuff like that, I'm like, I think about like Newsies or something. It is very like of a different
right
era.
Yes.
Sort of funsy and cute. That's not the reality we live in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So my computer just beeped at me. I've never heard it make that noise before. I hope that's good. It's good when your computer makes a random
yeah
sound, right?
That's what
only
they all say,
when like
especially
that
when you're podcasting.
Yeah, right? you definitely want something to go to, some new variable to be entered into the world of podcasting. I'm going to save, we're already going long. I'm going to say mine. I don't get to hear that often, but you do have new family members.
Yeah.
And one thing that happens when you have new family members of your kind is your reading habits. And
oh,
I guess
yeah
that's Jermaine here. Have you had any, are you listening? If you're already on the audiobook trains, it's a little bit easier. My great audiobook transition came when my kids were young, for reasons that are so obvious, it's not worth going into. But are you getting a chance to listen to stuff at all? Or are you doing it while you're taking care and changing and burping and feeding and all that stuff or not?
It's funny because my next post, which is not published yet for the deep dive, is about how I ended up, like, I think the last audiobook I listened to was Rosemary's Baby by Ira Lehman.
You're so weird. You're so weird. That's amazing.
This whole thing is about that. But one of the things I pointed out, I was like, I had this fantasy. I now know it's a complete fantasy of, like, during leave, finally getting through books on my TBR, and then, you know, incorporating the joy of audiobooks into these first months of, like, oh, I'm going to be, like, washing a bunch of bottles and things like that. I'll listen to an audiobook. And right now I'm like, the sound of silence in my own head is the thing I want to hear the most right now. So I have been... Yes. Not so great with the books, other than children's books right now. Children's books I'm living for, sure. Which is, you know, surprise, surprise, why I chose that one piece. Mm-hmm. But I am in the process of trying to figure out what my reading life in this current state with two, as of today, 4-month-old children is going to look like. Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah. I didn't want to out that you were dealing with multiples.
Yeah,
that's a whole different deal. I can only imagine. Yeah, I think you'll find. I mean, it ebbs and flows. Any children's books discoveries that you want to shout out before we get out of here?
I have honestly been selfishly leaning into children's books I love from my childhood.
Of course.
But I did read Llama Llama Red Pajama.
Yes.
Somebody sent that to us. So I can't even say it was because I wanted to explore what has been very popular in children's books as of lately. Mm. But I loved it. I totally get it. I read so many posts on our own site about how wonderful, like, rhyming is in children's books and, like, you know, analyzing the rhyming schemes and things. And I was like, yeah. And now I'm, as I read it aloud to the girls, I'm like, oh my goodness, this is wonderful. This is great. I love this book. So that's a big one that I keep going back to. And Spike Lee's book, Please, Baby, Baby, Please.
I don't know it. This exists?
Yeah. It's so cute. It's very cute. It's by Spike Lee. I wish I could think of the illustrator off the top of my head, but it's beautifully illustrated.
I'll put a link in
the show thank
notes,
you. Yeah, that's a really great one. Highly recommend.
If you haven't gotten on to the first of these books came out when my kids were young, The Little Blue Truck Industrial Complex, there's a billion of them now.
We have a couple
but
of
the
those.
The first one.
I haven't read them.
Okay, yeah. The first one is great. I read it so many times I can even remember. Horn went beep, engine purred, friendliest sound you ever heard. I'm going to tear
up.
Wow,
that's opening great.
Lines to Little Blue Truck right now. They're cute and they're rhyming and they make the sounds and it's pretty great. And anyway, you're just reading at your kids now. At 4 months old, they're blobs that poop at this point.
It's for me.
We all want to do it as early as we can. Yeah, I know. It's fine. That's good. There's no shame.
Yeah.
It's amazing. All right, Sharifa, thanks so much. Bookriot.com. Listen for the show notes. Also, subscribe to the Deep Dive. It sounds like you're going to be able to read about Sharifa's somewhat disturbing audiobook habits. I'm a scaredy cat, as everyone knows. And then my piece about, you know, how I wouldn't do what we're doing right now. That's a kind of a weird way. But you're a Book Riot, but thoughts on the current, past, and current media landscape there. The Patreon, Today in Books, all the things of the Book Riot and Book Riot Podcast Extended Universe are at the show notes. Shoot me an email, podcast@bookriot.com. And we'll talk to y'all later. Sharifa, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.